So let's begin with looking at the discretization. Discretization methods, they exist independent of the actual equation that you try to solve. So let's begin with developing one method of discretizing some function. So here, discretization. We are going to expand the function that we are going to look for into a set of basis functions. There are several basis functions available. You probably heard of all the orthogonal polynomials that exist out there, Chebyshev, Lagrange, Laguerre, Fourier polynomials, or spherical harmonics, and so on. What I was going to use in the example netbook is just Chebyshev polynomials because they're easy to use, have some nice properties. Of course, they're all built into Mathematica. But if you want to use something else, we can do that. That would keep me on my toes, make things more interesting for you, because I probably make more mistakes. Are you okay with Chebyshev polynomials, or do you want something else? Laguerre, Lagrange polynomials? We'll use Chebyshev polynomials, okay, be it is. All the code equations I'm going to write, can you read that? That's magnification 200, okay? Yes, yes, okay, okay. It's, of course, independent of the number of expansion coefficients that we are going to use. I'm just going to define a global constant n, setting that to 4 in the beginning. That defines how many of these expansion coefficients you're going to use. Later on, you can then just change the 4 to something else, for example, 10, and then rerun the whole notebook from top to bottom, and then you get the same result, except with a higher accuracy. The Chebyshev polynomials, let's just begin playing around with them. So let's plot them. A table of Chebyshev polynomials. Chebyshev, what is it? Chebyshev T. So all these polynomials in Mathematica don't have just the usual name that they have in mathematics. You would just call them T. Here they're called Chebyshev T because T could be anything. Mathematica, it's a big package. So it's Chebyshev T or spherical harmonic Y and so on. It's just the naming convention that Mathematica uses. I, x, I runs from 0 to n, of course. That's how we defined n. And the Chebyshev polynomials live on the interval from minus 1 to plus 1. Plot them. You see how they look. Of course, you knew that already. There's a constant polynomial, there's a linear one, there's the quadratic one, and there are the higher ones, the higher order ones. And you see they all have the nice property that at the end of the interval, they're all plus one or minus one. And you also see that the number of zeros they have, the zeroth order polynomial is no zero, one zero, two zeros, and so on and so forth, although that's not really relevant here. And the Chebyshev polynomials, they are also orthogonal with respect to a particular scalar product. So let's write down that scalar product. I didn't find it built into Mathematica, but it's a nice thing to check that. So let's call that a Chebyshev integral of two functions f and g. And this is, let's just write it down, integrate f of x, g of x, x goes from minus 1 to plus 1. And of course, that's not the particular integral. The Chebyshev polynomials are orthogonal with respect to a scalar product that has 1 minus x squared here as well. And then we can just evaluate that for the first set of Chebyshev polynomials. Just create a table, Chebyshev polynomial I times k. That would be table. And yep, there's an error. Do you see that? Yes, here. So the chebint function takes as input functions, so you have to pass it functions here. And we're just going to calculate the table of scalar products here. That takes a bit, because Mathematica needs to actually evaluate the integrals, proving whether this is actual zero or not. Hope it doesn't take too long. I should have output then in a nicer way. And then you see they're indeed orthogonal. Yes?
Did you have to define the interval over which the Chebyshev polynomials are defined? I mean, did you have to specifically specify minus 1 to 1?
Yes.
Not for the integral, I mean when you were plotting them, aren't they only defined over the interval minus 1 to 1?
No, the Chebyshev polynomials are polynomials. They exist everywhere. You can evaluate them everywhere. But they have these nice properties between 0, 1, and minus 1. And if you use that integral, they are orthogonal, as you see here. But you can evaluate them everywhere. Of course, they just become very large. Every polynomial just becomes very large. Pardon?
Okay, so which ones are those?
So the function space that we are considering is the closed interval from 0, 1 to plus 1,
okay.
And probably all analytic functions in there. Now you see all of these, they're actually not 1, but there's a factor pi over 2, so let me just get rid of that factor by modifying the Chebyshev interval integral. And then this looks nice. Yeah, it's a bit slow. Well, I'm not going to bother with trying to make things go fast. Of course, in real life, if you're spending a lot of time with a notebook, we would try to improve the speed of that, but that's not the aim of that lecture today. It would be rather simple to do, I guess. Maybe we just change the integral to numerical integral or change the order in which things are evaluated. Now, if you expand a function in Chebyshev polynomials, you get a set of coefficients that is going to be represented as a list. And if you want to reconstruct the function from these coefficients, that of course then looks approximately like this. You have a sum, and we have some coefficient. Take the coefficient number I and multiply Chebyshev T just sum over the respective coefficients. And actually, since I expect the list of coefficients here in Mathematica indexes lists starting from 1, not from 0, we have to add a plus 1 in here. And then we get this as a result. And of course, you can't calculate anything because I haven't actually given any coefficients. Actually, I want to generalize that. I want to have a function that takes as input a list of coefficients, and then its output produces the reconstructed function. So I call this C to F because it takes coefficients and converts it to a function. And the input is the coefficients that you can then evaluate. And then we can evaluate C to F on, for example, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is not what I expected. And then this is the result. And we can also simplify it. This is then the particular function here, that at this representation terms coefficients 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Nothing special so far. This is the easy way, once you have the coefficients, to go back to the function that these coefficients represent. And if you hear about discretization in another context, this is probably a step that people glance over. When one discretizes, then what is the complicated thing, of course, is performing the calculations with the coefficients with the function that is represented. Reconstructing the function is something that is unfortunately sometimes not mentioned. Yes?
So I've never seen a function defined like that with two brackets. Well, why would you do that?
Why not? I don't have to do that. So this is a function that then returns another function. It's a function of a function, which is technically the same as just using this, actually. So I can also write it this way. The result is the same. Yeah, I tried to make a distinction between the two function arguments, because the first function argument is a list of coefficients, and the second one is actually the continuous part. So in my mind, there was a function that takes a list of coefficients and returns a function. It's kind of an operator that creates a function, and then that syntax seemed natural to me. We also want the other thing. Once we have a function given, we want to project that onto our basis functions and get the coefficients out. So let's write the corresponding thing. That would be f to c, and the input is a function, and the output is a list of coefficients. You want to help me write that function? F, and then a basis function here that I steal from up here. And that's not quite it, because the output needs to be a list of coefficients. So we need to wrap that in a table. And that should work. Should it? So let's apply that, for example, to the sine function. Let's see what the output is. And you see Mathematica did it exactly. Here it calls the Bessel J function. Of course, that's not the Bessel function. That's the Bessel function evaluated at these points, the first and the third Bessel function evaluated at x at equals 1. This is just some number. I mean, you can evaluate that to any precision. It's just some particular real number that Mathematica just left unevaluated there, because that's the exact representation of that number. And now we can also perform a check if we have a consistency check. If we have a function given as terms of coefficients, we can reconstruct the function and then project back onto the basis, and we should get the same coefficients out. So we can try whether that is actually the case. Let's define some arbitrary coefficients. C underscore I. Yeah. These are just some arbitrary coefficients. Then we take these coefficients and we reconstruct the function. This is C to F. And then the function goes back to the coefficients. And let's see what happens. And Mathematica now proves that what we do is consistent. And nope, it didn't work. So we started with the coefficients here, and out come these coefficients here. Do you see what is going wrong here? Yeah, it's a pesky definition that the Chebyshev functions are not really orthonormal. They are just orthogonal. There's a special case. There are several ways to fix that. One way to correct that would be to redefine the first Chebyshev function to include a factor of square root of 2, and then this would work out. We can also correct our function f to c, which is what I'm going to do here, and add the particular factor in here. Yes?
How do you get the subscript on the c?
I press control minus. The minus key is the one that also has the underscore, and underscore is kind of a subscript thing. And you can also press control 6. The 6 key is the one that has the head, which is used in superscript. Then you can get a superscript. And if you don't want the underscore there, you can also use single brackets. That, I guess, would also work. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Sorry, I forgot, since it's with the pound sign and the ampersand mean, could you just...
Yes, so this is a function. So the function C to F takes two arguments.
Okay.
And I don't want to give a name of that, don't want to call it X, because if you evaluate that at the point X, then I get the value of the function at some unspecified point X. But what really I need to give as input is a function. So this is the syntax in Mathematica to create a function. So this is some argument that I don't give a name, and ampersand in the end means that the whole expression is a function that takes one argument. And the example that I showed yesterday was the sine function. If you write sine of, this is the same as the sine function, actually. Let's see whether Mathematica can actually prove that. No, it doesn't. But this is actually the equivalent. If you write this and then evaluate that at point X, you get sine of x as you expected. So we need to correct the f to c function, that the projection of the basis functions, to take the factor 2 into account. So f I equals 0, then a factor 1/2, else a factor of 1. Let's see whether that works. Let's evaluate that again. That seemed to have worked. So we now have, based on the Chebyshev functions, defined a generic way to represent functions in terms of lists of numbers. And these lists can be arbitrary long. And the hope is that the more basis coefficients you use, the more accurate the representation becomes. But for any finite number of coefficients that you use, that there's a particular error that one makes. And this is why it's called discretization, because instead of an infinite dimensional vector space, we have only a finite dimensional vector space. This means the system is discrete or is quantized in a certain way. I mean, not quantized in the sense of quantum mechanics, but quantized in the sense that not everything can be represented, that there are jumps in the system if you want to make small changes. If you want to solve a partial differential equation, then we also need to be able to take derivatives. And the key idea is there that if you have a function given in these terms of expansion coefficients and you apply a derivative, then it's not necessary to reconstruct the full function, take a derivative, and project it back onto the basis coefficients. Instead, you can do that right away on the basis coefficients. And for the Chebyshev functions, in other words, the derivative operator is going to be a matrix. It's a linear operator. And given that we just use basis coefficients, which form a vector, the derivative operator has a representation as a matrix. And if you have a discretization method and you want to solve a PDE, then you need to obtain this representation of the derivative operator. Of course, it depends on the particular choice of basis functions that you have. For the Chebyshev functions, actually well known how this derivative operator looks like, but I don't want to just write it down. I want to use a generic way to define the derivative operator. So we can take this basis functions. I can take these basis functions, then reconstruct. Now let's write it like this. Reconstruct the function. Then take a derivative of that with respect to x. Let's see what happens here. And then I can take this expression and then convert that back, project it back onto the Chebyshev polynomials. Have to see. Is this what I expected, or is this now suddenly too complicated? I was not expecting to see the integrals there. Yes. Now I see why this doesn't work. Because f to c expects a function. I hope that this now works. So if I start with a function represented in this way, that can be an arbitrary function, and then take the derivative, it is going to have this representation in terms of the coefficients. And you notice two properties. First, the coefficient C0 does not appear in this list of coefficients. That makes sense. The coefficient C0 represents the constant polynomial. And of course, if you take the derivative is going to be independent of that. Also, you notice that there's a zero here in the end. That means the highest power does not appear in the representation of the derivative. And that is also the case because we made a cutoff. There are no higher powers, higher polynomials present in the expansion that we're using since we cut off at n. And that means the highest power will actually, after taking the derivative, have a coefficient of zero. And we now need to turn that into a matrix. So let's give this a name. And then we are going to define the respective matrix. DD equals CI. Is this correct? Did I get the transpose or something? This does not look correct. Yeah, something's fishy here. Can you help me out? Mm. Thank you. Thank you. Very good. Yes, I made the same mistake yesterday. And it's still the transpose that I have for some reason. And this is now the derivative operator in matrix form. And you know, you see that for Chebyshev polynomials, it actually looks very simple, the functional form that it has here. There's 4, 6, 8. And if the matrix was larger, it would continue with 12, 10, 12, and so on. And there's 4 and 8 here. 6, the next one would be 10. 8 would continue 0, 12, and so on. And the first row is actually special. There's this factor 2 that we explicitly introduced. If we were to use the original Chebyshev polynomials, that would be also 2 and 6, making this pattern here look much nicer. So what I did here was brute force with going from coefficients to the function, taking derivative, projecting back, and so on. If you know the properties of your basis functions, you can, of course, create the derivative operator right away, which is what we should have done. I was just too lazy to do that because that is an exercise in the properties of the Chebyshev functions, which is not the object of the lecture today. Yes?
How do you do
the subscript? That is control and minus. So the minus key is the same key that has the underscore, and underscore is for subscript. Okay, let me try to confuse you a bit more by changing the notation here a bit. And now DD is a matrix, so we can write DD.cs matrix form. And this should be the same as the one up here. That is C1 plus 3TC and so on. It's actually the same output. So our definition of the derivative matrix is correct. And we can also get the second derivative. That, of course, is now rather easy. So the operator for a second derivative looks like this. It's the derivative of the derivative, just the product of the matrix DD. Oh. I have the tendency to actually type very quickly. And if you want to type yourself and find your own errors, then I'm probably going to way too fast for what you are doing. So please stop me. You're nodding. OK, so let me stop 2 minutes. And let's recap what we did, because right now we're actually then going to do something else. We're going to introduce the actual partial differential that we're going trying to go to solve. So do you have questions so far? Is this all clear? There's a bit of mathematical magic, but nothing too deep. There is projection onto function space. Yes?
So I'm confused as to why the output of F2C is a list. I think it goes very
So the argument
of
F...
the scalar product of each of the outputs with each of the polynomials.
I'm sorry, F2C takes a function as argument. Do you mean C to F?
With each of the polynomials
in turn of that list. Yes.
Okay.
And that happens, so your output is a table, is a list. And the length of the list is determined by the parameter n. And we also, in the F2C, we also introduced this factor 1/2 for the first Chebyshev polynomial to ensure that there, I mean, that needs to be done to make, to actually project it onto it. Still too fast? Do you have other questions? Okay. Just to make sure that you don't lose the overview of what we are going to do here, the object of the lecture today is to take a partial differential equation, the heat equation, in particular stationary heat equation, and to solve it numerically. So in the first part of the lecture, I have already introduced a way to discretize the function. That is, you take the function, and instead of representing it as a function, you represent it as a set of numbers, as the vector of coefficients. And the number of coefficients describes the accuracy that one does. And there is now also a way to discretize the derivative operator. The regular derivative operator acts on the infinite dimensional function space, but after discretizing, we have a discrete derivative operator that does not make any reference anymore to the full function space. Instead, it acts only in the restricted function space, where the functions are represented by the basis coefficients. And both the input and the output of the derivative operator are then basis coefficients. And this is what then can be done, can be handled efficiently by computers. So let's introduce the heat equation and let's solve it numerically. The heat equation means that you have, I'm going to do that in one dimension. Of course, in one dimension, equations are much easier to solve than in multiple dimensions. In one dimensions, it's very likely that you can get the result from Mathematica just by entering the equation, which is why I'm using a one-dimensional equation, that we can actually cross-check our results by using Mathematica. Of course, the interesting equations are often multiple, have often multiple independent variables, 2D, 3D problems. But in this case here, it's just a 1D problem. So the heat equation, the stationary heat equation means the second derivative of x is given by some kind of right-hand side, could be zero, but actually, let me use the right-hand side here, and just to make it interesting, I'll define equation for the right-hand side. Pi x, yes, why not pi x? What? Oh, no, I defined f above. Okay, that, of course, was a mistake. I shouldn't have done that, because now it uses f. Yeah, that looks better. Yes.
Until what extent is this discretization? How do you say that? Good in the sense that it's precise and accurate.
That because depends on how smooth the function is. Okay. So maybe it's time to make a general comment about discretizations. So there are different discretization methods, of course, have different ways of representing the derivative operators and so on. What I'm presenting here, it is so-called spectral method, and it's called a spectral method because the representation is similar to a Fourier transform. It's not a Fourier transform because we're using the interval minus 1 to plus 1. We don't assume periodicity, but the Chebyshev polynomials have similar properties to the Fourier polynomials in that sense. And these representations are known to be highly accurate if the function is smooth. So I don't really know how to define what the smooth function is, but you have a function that looks like this, then it's probably smooth. If you have a function that looks like this, then it's not smooth here. And this here can probably accurately be represented by just 4 or 5 Chebyshev polynomials. And this one, I don't know. You have to look at that length here comparing to that length here, so you probably need 80 or 100 different Chebyshev polynomials. And there are different kinds of discretization methods. The spectral methods use a more global approximation, and there are different sets of basis functions that would be more appropriate for this one here. For example, you can use what is called hat functions for that. Each basis function then looks like this. So it's kind of it's piecewise linear, line up, line down here, and the next basis function would then be this one. Actually, there would also be one basis function here, and so on. So just these hat functions that move from left to right. And if you represent it in this, then it's very clear that you can represent these jagged edges rather easily if you just make sure that these hat functions are just small enough. And then you need maybe 100 of these, but using these is much cheaper than Chebyshev polynomials because it's essentially just the same function, piecewise linear. It's very easy to handle, unlike Chebyshev polynomials that becomes very complicated for large powers.
So you could do the discretization patchwise as well, piecewise too, like have, for the smooth part of this function, you could, within an interval, you can use for the smooth part a particular form of discretization. Then for this jagged part, you can use the hat function.
Yes, that would be possible. One usually doesn't do that because this function may be the solution of a PDE. And when you try to solve something, you don't know the solution. But what some people do is called adaptive refinement, where you first do an approximation with a coarser resolution, and then you look where the error is large. And in these regions, you then use different discretization functions or more basis functions like this. But that's an advanced topic. And especially in 3D or in higher dimension, that becomes quite complicated. And just keeping track of which basis function you use in what space and so on, that can be highly complex. And of course, I'm not going to do that today. Yes?
My question was pointing towards, what if I take, for example, the coefficients of a function, derive it, obtain the coefficients, and use this prescription of the discretized derivative and compare the coefficients?
This is what we did.
Right. But I'm using, for example, for the sine function, I'm checking the coefficients and compare the derivative of those of that function. I mean, the coefficients of cosine with the ones that we can obtain by multiplying with the derivative matrix, and they don't match.
Of course they don't match,
right?
Because the sine function cannot be represented exactly. But that is something that we can just do as an example, actually, up here, to look at the sine function and how it's represented,
right,
and the derivative and so on. But there was another question. Sorry, let's go to that first. Yes. DD. So this is, calculating DD that way is cheating. And actually what we're doing in DD here is, because we are using the F to C that also contains a projection back into the function space. In different discretization methods, you may want to define the DD operator differently. Even that property that we're using, that if you go back to the original function and then project back into the coefficients, that this is the identity, you may not want to use that in your definition of a discretization methods. That there is a whole slew of methods out there, and they all have different properties that could be important or could be relevant. What I'm doing here is just the most simple thing, because it's natural in Mathematica to do these kind of projections. But if you find another discretization method, you probably will be able to rewrite the description that it fits the pattern that I'm presenting here, but it will probably use a very different language, and the word projection may not even appear in if the discretization method is described to you. So let's actually do that. Let's find the coefficients of the sine function. How was that? That was F to C sine. Why is this so slow? Anyway, could be. And actually, this, of course, is now Mathematica doing an exact integral. What you typically would do is you would evaluate that numerically. You're not interested in whether this is the Bessel J function evaluated 1.1. You just want an approximate representation in terms of numbers, and then you would get something like this. Let's call this actually a discretized sine function. And then we can also take the derivative of that, which is then that. And what we can also do is we can take the derivative of the sine function and calculate the discretization of that, which is reverse the order of the two steps of taking the derivative and getting the discrete coefficients. And now the result should be similar. And yes, it is similar. Look, the first two digits actually agree. And this coefficient is 0. And here the first digit agrees. And of course, that there's actually something up here that we completely lost in the discretization. So the results are similar, which is good. But it also means there's an error. And if you look at the error, then kind of in the 1, 2, 3, 3rd power, there's something. So the error is in the percent range or something, which means if you plot something, a percent range error, you probably don't see it very much, but the error is still there. Actually, we should just do that. Let's plot it. Plot first the original one, which is sine prime of x, and then the derivative. That is c to f of dd dot sine. Thank you. Yeah, that's also why it's blue. Good. And so what we're taking these coefficients that we have here that are not quite the same and converting them back into a function. And these are the functions that I'm plotting here. And in the result, you see that they're kind of similar. But if you zoom in, then you see some discrepancies here and here. So that's the error that one makes. And yes? Mm-mm. You're just comparing?
Yeah.
Okay. Is something not working on your notebook?
It's the question.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I mean, if there's an error somewhere further up. Oh, what you can do is can try to quit the kernel and then reevaluate everything top to bottom. Because if you made some wrong definition, then Mathematica will remember that, even if you deleted it afterwards. Mm. Yeah, what I like to do is evaluation, quit kernel, local, quit. And now, of course, Mathematica forgot all the definitions. And then I gone to evaluation, evaluate notebook. Now it takes a bit because all the slow things that we did at the beginning have to be redone. but after that.
Is there a way to debug your code?
What do you mean by debugging?
So
debugging
doesn't exist.
No, but you can just output things, look at expressions, and so on.
Mm-hmm. So there's a function that will show you the computer trace too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean?
Sort of, I think.
So we kind of did some debugging earlier. I introduced an error. If you remember, in the very beginning, the F2C definition was wrong because it didn't have that if expression here. And this was debugging. We calculated the coefficients, ran C to F, F to C, and the result was 2 here. So this was actually debugging, but I didn't call it debugging. And that's much easier in Mathematica than in other languages because you can interact with a notebook much more easily than if you write a Fortran program and you have to add print statements and run it and you don't know it. And it's just more awkward. It's just much more natural to do it in a notebook. Okay. So let me continuing with defining the heat equation. That is something that has nothing to do with discretization. If you want to solve the heat equation, you also need boundary conditions. Oh, yes, I wanted to point that out. Let's look at the derivative operator up here again. Actually, the second derivative operator. That's the dd dot d2. You see it has many zeros. In particular, there are two rows full of zeros. That means this operator doesn't have full rank. It has a kernel. German word is kernel. What is the English word? Kernel. Yes. And actually, so if you can't invert that operator, and the task of the boundary conditions is to provide, in this case, since kernel has dimension 2, two independent conditions that you can add to that matrix, and then you can invert the operator. This is why you need boundary conditions. In terms of functional analysis and PDEs, it's typically called boundary conditions, as if this was the only way to correct the equation. But if you just look at the linear operator, you just need two other linear independent conditions. It doesn't have to be boundary conditions. You can also provide another condition. For example, you could say that the average of the resulting function should be 0. That would also work, but also provide a condition. Now, let's define some boundary conditions for the heat equation. And this is f of minus 1 equals, I had some nice coefficients worked out. Let me see whether I remember them. It's 1 over 10, and f of plus 1, we set that to 0. And then we should be able to just solve that. Let's plug it into dsolve. So we combine the equation and the boundary conditions. Mathematica needs to be told both. We solve for f, and the independent variable is x. Yes, that worked. And you see how quickly Mathematica solved that problem, that we are going to take more than an hour to solve numerically with much less precision. But then this is a rather simple equation. We can now plot that. We need to give that a name, so let's call it analytic solution. This is not what I wanted. Something is wrong here. The solution. Oh, no, that is correct. That is correct. Okay. So this here has nothing to do with discretization. This is just solving, giving a particular partial differential equation, solving it analytically. Actually, let's make a distinction here. This up here is just the definition of the partial differential equation that we're going to try to solve. And solving it in Mathematica like this is easy. Yes? Yes. I'm going way too fast now. Yes. So I didn't want to set the right-hand side of the differential equation to 0, which is why I defined a function, a right-hand side function. It's just sine of pi x, just to make something interesting happen. Then I defined the differential equation, which means f double prime of x is the right-hand side. Boundary conditions set the left and the right boundary conditions. 1 over 10 and 0 respectively, and then you just stuff that into dSolve and get the solution out.
You're taking the boundary conditions at the two extremal points of your interval, right?
Yes.
So if I want to solve a differential equation that has boundary conditions at infinity, where I'm not working just in an interval minus 1.
Okay, yes. If you do that numerically, that doesn't work because the number infinity is not the real number, so you can't do that. What you would have to do is use one of the two tricks. One, you just use a large number instead of infinity.
Okay.
You say apply the boundary condition at 10 or at 1,000 or so. And the other way would be to apply a coordinate transformation that the boundary condition is not at infinity, but is somewhere else instead. But handling infinity is actually a non-trivial problem if you do something numerically. And I think most people prefer to just to put the boundary at some large way, 10, and then you solve the equation again, putting the boundary at 20, compare the differences. If it doesn't differ by much, where much depends on how accurate you need to be, then it's good enough.
These boundary conditions make the second derivative matrix representation invertible?
If we combine the boundary conditions and the derivative operators, then it will have full rank. And that's the next step that we're going to do once we solve it numerically. But I wanted to wait a few minutes until other people have caught up. I don't want to leave anyone behind. On the other hand, I could also just move ahead and leave some of you behind because we're going to meet this afternoon, and then I can spend some one-on-one time correcting your Mathematica notebooks. It depends on what you prefer. But if we now wait another 10 minutes, then I may not be able to finish actually solving it numerically. So it depends on what you want, because it's your lecture, right? Okay. Did you have another question? Pardon?
So when you are solving analytically, what do you answer to set boundary conditions at infinity?
I would try something like f infinity equals 0 or so. Okay.
So when you have this whole, you're putting the list, which is the differential equation you want to solve, on a list of rules, which are the boundary conditions, right?
Yes.
Right, and when you plot it, you say f of x applied to a solve at 1.
Yeah, so here I store the solution, which is a list of lists. The outermost list numbers the solutions that Mathematica found. It found only one solution. And the innermost list gives the solution for all the functions or variables that Mathematica looked at. Here we're only solving for one function. So again, it's a list of one element. So it's kind of a list of lists, but each time the list only has one element. What I'm doing here in ASOL of 1, I pick the first solution, which is also the only solution. And then this actually comes in terms of a rule. So I put that in here, f of x.
Okay.
Yes, so this is an expression f of x. And this f is going to be replaced by that function. And since this is a function, it can be evaluated at x, so the plot can actually then plot the result. Yes? No, go ahead. There are no stupid questions.
Because we're
combining several different things here, right? On one hand, using Mathematica to solve PDEs, that is in and itself a complex topic. Then there's the strange list notations with curly braces and join and list of lists, which is complex. And then I'm introducing today how to do something numerically, which is still in the back of your heads because I'm actually continuing to use that. So there are many things that could go wrong. Okay, let's continue with the numeric solution. This is not what I wanted. So I actually also need to be able to represent the boundary conditions. That is something that I glanced over, because when people speak of solving PDEs, then everybody talks about the differential equation. But the boundary conditions are, I mean, at least technically as important as the equation itself. And you also need to put some effort in. So what I need to do now is to be able to apply the boundary conditions. And for that, I need an operator that projects onto the boundary. I have the coefficients, and then I... Does that make sense? Yes, so I want to do that discretely. So I want to have a discrete operator that, given the coefficients, gives me the boundary values that allows me to apply the boundary conditions. Does this make sense?
But
Wait, so you're not, you don't have the boundary values as inputs for your differential equation?
Well, I have a function given in terms of coefficients, and I want to impose a condition on these coefficients. So I need to know how to calculate the boundary value from these coefficients. So let's call it, I mean, when I discrete something, I use this DD for the derivative operator just to make sure I don't get confused. I'm just using double letters for everything that is discrete. So let me call it BB, the thing for the boundary condition, and BBL is then an operator that takes as input the list of coefficients, and the output is the boundary value at the left boundary.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean. So are you saying like set your function at the boundary condition equal to the boundary condition and then solve for the coefficient, get some condition on the coefficient?
Yes, that is the idea, yes.
Okay.
So the input, tap. Okay. So the DD operator is a derivative operator. And the boundary condition is technically also a linear operator. It is the operator that takes the solution, the coefficients, and projects it onto the boundary values. So it's not a square matrix. It's a matrix that's 2 by n elements, because the output should be the left and the right boundary values. Doesn't make sense? Maybe I should just write it down. I hope I get it correct. So I'm just copy and pasting the derivative operator thingy up there. Boundary conditions are No, I want to have an operator that projects onto the boundary. Let's make
I
it simpler.
Exactly understand what you mean by that. An operator that
So I have a function given in terms of coefficients.
Yes.
And I want to use these coefficients to determine the value at the left boundary.
So
because I mean, if I want to impose a boundary, I want to impose the boundary condition not onto the functions, but onto the coefficients. So I know I need to have an operator that has as input the list of coefficients and as output the value at the boundary. So it's not a square operator, or if we say, let's just use the left boundary, it is an n by 1 operator.
So the operator won't be unique, right? Because you have a choice on, so you have 2 conditions on 4 coefficients. So you can
actually there are 5 coefficients.
Okay, so, you have 2 conditions.
Yes.
2 equations, so that means you can take away 2 of the coefficients and you'll be left with 3 coefficients, but you have a choice of which ones you want to take away. So you can make a whole bunch of different projections.
Yes, but it's a linear system, so it doesn't matter, because
right.
I only need to make sure that the derivative operator and the boundary condition operator, that they're linearly independent, which they are going to be. And then I need to construct it. So L for left, and that's why I did like this.
So can you go through the big picture here?
Okay, so what I want to do is I want to apply a boundary condition.
Yeah.
And the boundary condition is a condition that is imposed onto the coefficients. And the coefficients are just some abstract representation of the function. And the boundary condition means that the function evaluated, say, at the left boundary, needs to have a particular value.
Yeah.
And this is a condition onto the coefficients. Or now I want to have an operator that takes as input the conditions and as output produces the value at the left boundary. So this is just like evaluating the function at the left boundary. So I have the coefficients.
But isn't your whole goal in solving the differential equation to obtain these very coefficients?
Yes, which is why I define it as an operator. The operator has as input coefficients, and as output, it produces the boundary values. Like the derivative operator, it has its input coefficients and its output coefficients again, although I don't know the coefficients. But it's an operator, and then I know the matrix representation of the operator, and I also know the matrix representation of the boundary operator. The boundary operator is not something that one typically uses, but it is just it projects onto the boundary. It's a one or a delta function at the boundary and zero everywhere else, if you so want. Good, yeah, that makes sense, right? Pardon? Yeah, so if I have an arbitrary function given in these of coefficients, then the left boundary value is given by that expression, z0 minus z2 plus z4.
But isn't the left boundary
at
negative 1
less than 0? Ha ha, thank you. No, very good. Yeah, that's why I need you. Yeah, see, you need actually all coefficients. Makes much more sense. And there's also boundary coefficients for the right boundary. And now I'm going to put this into a matrix form, which is actually the same as we did for the derivative operator up here. I don't need I, and then I have B coefs left. Hey, B, like this. Very good. And I copy that for the right boundary. Now this is not very elegant because I treat the left and the right boundary separately. I have to kind of write everything twice. What I did in the other notebook that I prepared was to actually have a list with left and right boundary, which is more elegant. But right now, I don't want to go through the complication here. The function coefficient takes an expression and calculates the coefficient that coefficient has. So you can, for example, look for a coefficient of x squared in a sum, or in this case, it just takes. So the input is kind of expected to be a sum, and it drops all the terms where this coefficient doesn't appear. You can take something apart. So, yep, that is what I wanted in the end. This is now a boundary operator, which is 0 here. This is the left boundary value, and this is the right boundary value. I'm sorry that I didn't explain the magic here, but we can compare that to the derivative operator, actually second derivative operator that we're going to use, which looks like this. And you know, if you see, if they're by themselves, none of them have full form, full rank. But if they're going to be added together, then we're going to get the matrix that has full rank, and that can then be inverted. And that is then the solution of the system.
What is the array in the 0?
Oh, what I did here in this join, so I have these two individual vectors, bb left and bb right, which I want to have here in these rows. And the array here just creates an array of dimension n minus 2 plus 1 and n plus 1, which is the 3 by 5 array. And this is like the table function, except the table function takes as input an expression, and array takes as input a function. So I want it to be 0, and 0 is an expression of 0. Ampersand is a function. It's a function that is 0 everywhere. It doesn't even look at its argument. It's the constant function 0.
So if you had just put 0, wouldn't it?
No, because I can try that. But does the difference between a 0 function and a 0 value, if you just put 0 there, then what Mathematica does, it thinks 0 is a function, which it isn't, and calls that function with the indices as arguments. And then you'll get these strange things there. So I use a function here. OK. Pardon? Yes, I can use table. OK, let me use table, which is 0. And then I have to introduce I, 0, n. J, 0, n. Now n minus 2 I wanted to use here. Is this correct? Same thing. And that works as well. I used array because it was shorter. Sorry if I confused you with that. Table is cleaner now. OK. So you remember how we spent 5 or 10 minutes in the beginning defining the derivative operator? What I did know very quickly is essentially the same Berg defining the boundary operator, where you take the function that you have and project it onto the boundary, and then you can apply a boundary condition because you know the values at the boundary. Sorry, that was a bit confusing. Now what I want to do is actually solve the equation. That is, I'm going to write a discrete version of this one here, of this differential equation. And to do this, well, actually of this equation and the boundary condition. So for that, one needs a discrete version of the second derivative. We have that. That's the dd dot dd. We need to be able to evaluate the function at minus 1 and plus 1. That is the bb operator that I just defined. These values go in as they are. And we'd also need to discretize the right-hand side function, which is the one up here. So let's begin by doing that, by discretizing the right-hand side function. What? I don't want omega. Jesus. This is a list of coefficients. So we take the right-hand side function and call f to c. Then we get the discretized version. And just for the fun of it, let's now plot the difference between the original right-hand side function and the discrete right-hand side function. That's the same as we did for the sine function up there. So we have the right-hand side function and the c to f and we see it's not so good anymore, because we're just using 4 Chebyshev polynomials. That's actually a bit of an error that one makes. I believe the blue function is the original one, the sine function, and the red one is the one represented by the Chebyshev polynomials, slightly wrong values at the boundary. But it's not actually that important. If you solve the equation, that won't make too much of a difference. Then we need to construct our operator, the left-hand side. Is this, and the right-hand side. There we need to put the discrete right-hand side, exactly, yes. There has one. OK, now I'm actually trying to concentrate to get this right. And I find it a bit difficult of trying to concentrate, then explaining it at the same time. So if you bear with me, I'm going to write something down for 30 seconds, and then please ask questions. So let's see whether that works. What? How can that be? You're wrong. OK, it seems to have worked. Now, what we have to do now is stitch together the system. We have, on one hand, we have the differential equation, which doesn't have full rank. On the other hand, we have the boundary condition, which doesn't have full rank. So I'm taking the square matrix, which doesn't have full rank for the differential operator. I'm kind of removing the last two rows and replace that with the boundary condition operator instead. This is what I did here, because they actually have zeros in there. I can just add them to do that. I need to do the same thing for the right-hand side vector. I need to drop two of the coefficients. That is, I need to take n minus 2 plus 1 coefficients, since n is 4 and I want 3 coefficients. I'm going to take just 3 coefficients. And then I join that with the boundary conditions at the left and at the right. And of course, I have to make sure that the order works and so on. That's a bit ugly, stitching together matrices like that. That you could also do that differently. Yes?
So you really end up just representing the right-hand side with 3 Chebyshev polynomials, not 5, because you have to throw away 2 to enforce the boundary conditions, is that right?
Yes.
So it should be even worse than that approximation you have up there, right? Like the plot?
In a sense, yes. Okay. But since the right-hand side is only equal to the second derivative of the function, that means these higher coefficients will not be used anyway, because these higher coefficients for the right-hand side would correspond to the fourth and fifth or third and fourth power of the Chebyshev polynomials, and they will not be there anyway. So this would actually be an inconsistency. So we have to set them to zero to get something consistent. Yes. So this is the stitching that I did. That is the ugly part.
Absolutely.
That was up here. So I define these two vectors, BB left and BB right, that given coefficients calculate, okay, instead of projection, I should say calculate the left and the right boundary value. And then I created a matrix out of that by just adding zeros on top of that. And that if you compare it to the second derivative operator, you know that the zeros are just complementary, so you can just add the matrices together.
Would this have always happened?
Pardon?
Would this have always happened? So if they had like some third derivative, you would need an extra boundary condition, so the zeros would always match up, line up with the...
Well, the zeros do not always match. What you really have to do is you have to construct overall an operator that has full rank. And depending on how you define your derivative operator, you know where the zeros are going to be. For example, if you use this representation with the functions like this, then you don't know how to calculate the derivative at the left and at the right ends of the interval. So the places where you need to apply the boundary conditions are at the boundary already, because it's a local representation. And in a global representation, when you take a derivative, always the highest coefficient is going to be zero. So you know you have to take away the highest coefficients. So you kind of know what to do there. And then, well, what you can also do is you construct the full operator, stitching it together with the boundary conditions, and then you just see whether the operator has full rank or not. And you don't need to stitch it together. You can just also take some linear combinations of these operators, because it's linear at that point. It always works. Of course, in the end, you actually may have a nonlinear system, but that is something else. So if you have a nonlinear system, then you may not actually need a boundary condition to find a solution, because the nonlinearity also imposes additional conditions, then you may be fine. Okay. And what I sneakily did, actually, is, of course, already solve the system. There is this function called linear self. Let's look at that. And let's evaluate it numerically. Then we have an idea. So the coefficients of the solution look like that. And of course, what we've all been waiting for, the coefficients don't tell us anything. Let's just plot the solution. So I'm going to plot the analytic solution, which I already did up here. And in the same graph, also the numeric solution. Am I going too fast? I probably do. And this is C to F of the numeric solution evaluated at X. Oh, no. Wow, this is bad. OK, something's wrong. Help. Did I mix up the boundary condition somehow? Was it plus 110 by the other time? You know that and you don't tell me. Wow, no, this is still not very good, actually. There's a bug somewhere, because I tried the same problem yesterday, and actually, it looks very good. I don't quite know what went wrong. My suspicion is that when I stitched the matrices together, that something went wrong there, and doesn't work out. Let me just look at the boundary conditions, f of minus 1, f of plus 1. Boundary conditions left and right. No, I don't see what's wrong here. Sorry for scrolling so quickly. That doesn't help you understand the problem. OK, so that is the problem if I try to develop something interactively instead of just showing you the ready-made notebook. I can upload or ask you to upload the ready-made notebook where things work, and then you can look at that. But
Of the
RHS, yes. So right-hand side is a function, and I apply the F to C to that, and then I get the coefficients for the right-hand side. It's the discretized right-hand side. Okay. We can also change the right-hand side. And let's just do that for fun. So here that's the different right-hand side. This is a step function. It's zero everywhere except from 0 to 1/2. And the analytic solution that Mathematica finds is then, of course, needs the case distinction between the three different ranges that x has. And since the right-hand side is piecewise continuous, the result is a piecewise polynomial of order 2. And if you plot that, then the result looks like that. Since it's a second-order equation and the right-hand side is 0, so there is a stretch of a line and another stretch of a linear piece, and they're stitched together by a parabola. And of course, all the coefficients are chosen, so everything is nicely continuous and smooth and continuous. We can also do that numerically now. And this is now the right-hand side's plotted. And as you see, the right-hand side, which is this box function, and representing the right-hand side with Chebyshev polynomials is not a good idea. So of order 4, you get this one as a representation of this. That, of course, is a huge error. You would need to use many more basis coefficients in order to make that look nice. You can solve it numerically. And if you plot the two results, then they actually still look kind of similar to each other. Kind of surprising, given how bad the representation of the right-hand side was. Okay. Now, the basic idea behind discretization is that as you increase the number of basis functions that you're using, your solution becomes more and more accurate. Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense. There must be some convergence there. I'm not going to prove that this converges, but we can repeat the same steps by just using more basis functions, which is why I introduced the number n above. Let me just use 10 basis functions up here. Plot that. Looks a bit wild. I'm not going to repeat the proof that these are orthogonal to each other, because that would take a long time. But I'm going to repeat, of course, the definition of the derivative operator. This also takes a bit of a long time. But as I mentioned before, we know the basis functions, the derivative operator. We could define that directly, not via this complicated way. Because we know how the derivatives of Chebyshev functions can be expressed in terms of other Chebyshev functions. Okay, my laptop fan is now working. Okay, I'm getting nervous here. I hope I don't have an error that makes all of this break. Now you see the nice structure of the derivatives of the Chebyshev function. There's a lot of regularity, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 12, 16, 20, and so on. That means we could have created the matrix in a much easier manner than evaluating like that with Mathematica. This is a well-known property of the Chebyshev functions, and is one of the reasons why I actually use the Chebyshev functions. The boundary coefficients still have that alternating pattern of quite large now. Second derivative, analytic solution, numeric solution. Now there are more coefficients in the discretized right-hand side. And if you plot that, then this is the Chebyshev approximation of that box function, and we are getting closer to the actual shape now. The linear solution, again, is still really quick. And if you plot the function now, then you see that the solution actually is quite close with just 10 Chebyshev coefficients in this case, which is what we would hope, that as you increase the number of coefficients, you're getting closer and closer to the actual solution. Okay. I'm sorry for having gone a bit quickly in the past 10 or 15 minutes. I think I lost some of you looking at the blank stares that I'm getting from you. I'm going to see you again this afternoon, where we can go through some of the steps and explain that a bit better. And then I can also make sure that you actually can repeat all the steps if you didn't manage to type in what I typed from the screen in your notebooks right now. Can I send you my Mathematica notebook and you put it on the wiki? Then we can look at it this afternoon. Okay. Do you have questions on this?
Yeah, I have a few questions. You choose the boundary conditions at the extremal points of your interval.
Yes.
Right? But I can choose my boundary condition elsewhere, right? Specifying the value of a function.
Boundary conditions are at the boundaries.
So on the discrete system, you can choose them everywhere.
Yeah.
The continuum limit requires that. No, in one dimensional, you can choose them everywhere. That's correct. But in two dimensions, the system is ill-posed unless you actually apply boundary conditions on the boundary. This is a special thing of one dimension. One dimension, you can apply two conditions anywhere, or you can even apply two conditions at the same point, say function and derivative. Mm-mm.
If I change my boundary conditions, does the operator that gives me the coefficients, I mean the conditions on the coefficients, will be different?
Yes. The BB left and BB right would be different.
Right, but it is guaranteed that the sum of that operator plus the differential operator is unbreakable?
No, not necessarily the sum. That is a special case. And I also had to shift the BB thingies just in the zeros of the derivative operator. So it is guaranteed for linear system that there is a linear combination of DD and BB that is invertible, but not necessarily just the sum, as we did here. So you have to be careful there.
If I go a higher order in the derivative, when I have to specify, for example, a boundary condition for the first derivative, we can do something similar like this.
Yes, but something similar like this will always work. It could also be that of the DD operator, I mean, in a more complicated situation, that all the rows are non-zero. It's just it still has zero rank, right? It still has a kernel. And in that case, you would have to choose a clever way of applying boundary conditions. If the matrix is small, say 4x4 or 10x10, it doesn't really matter what you do. But if the matrix becomes larger, then you want to look at the condition number of the matrix. It's the ratio of the largest and the smallest eigenvalue. And you want to choose a linear combination that the condition number is as close to 1 as possible. If the condition number is 1, then all the eigenvalues are 1, then you have the identity matrix. So that, of course, is the ideal case that you're not going to achieve. But that is an important property of the matrix then.
Right, we only have one variable. So,
yes.
So, I guess it's not clear to me what to do if you have even two variables. How would you expand?
Okay. So, if you have two variables, you need to have a basis that covers two variables. The simplest way would then be to choose the unit square or the square for -1 to +1, and then use tensor products of Chebyshev polynomials, and then you have two indices I and j that describe the basis functions. And since you still want a vector space, you then need to define an index mapping. You take the two indices, I and j, and create a single multi-index from that runs from 1 to n squared instead two indices running, what? So you just multiply or add them or something in some way.
Okay. So the actual coefficient measure could be like a 4 by,
It depends.
It'd be a more complicated tensor, but then you just map that into a regular matrix. Is that the idea?
Yes, depending on where you do the mapping, yes. So you can write it then as a fourth order tensor, but if you want to use linear solve or any of the linear algebra methods that exist, you want to map that to a two-dimensional tensor. But I mean, it's just, it's a trivial thing, right? So if you use a computer, you don't even need to move everything in memory around. It's really just something on the index space that happens because you have two-dimensional index space, but that is equivalent to a linear index again. Okay. Okay, thank you very much. See you later.